Tonight is part four of our series on Orthodoxy and Society, which is drawing very, very heavily from the document known as the Social Concept of the Russian Orthodox Church, put out in the year 2000. And some of the things we've covered up until now have been everything from church and nation, church and state, questions about property, questions about labor and its fruits, questions about war and peace. And tonight we're getting to crime and punishment. So we're here tonight focusing on part nine of this incredible document. We'll start with crime, punishment, and reformation. So I'm going to start into this here. Christians are called to be law-abiding citizens of their homeland on earth, accepting that every soul should be subject to higher powers, as Paul says. At the same time, remembering the commandment of Christ to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. The human sinfulness, however, generates crime, which is a violation of the limits established by law. At the same time, our conception of sin in the church is much broader than just the idea of secular crime, quite naturally. So sin and crime are related, but they're not the same thing. Sin goes to the heart of man. Crime is dealing with the regulations, things we can legislate, etc. The primary cause of crime, we believe, is a darkened heart. For out of the heart, the Lord said, proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, etc. And we also believe one of the major tasks of the state, as we said a couple weeks ago, is to limit sin, to limit evil. So the state, one of the state's role and the church's role in the society is to support the state in considering things that will help limit criminal activity. So the prevention of crime is possible, first of all, through education, enlightenment, of course, aimed at sort of grounding us in authentic spiritual values. It is the task of our church to engage in intensive cooperation with schools, media, police, etc., anyone we can partner with. If people lack a positive moral ideal, no measure of coercion or legislation will stop the evil. You know, the old adage is democracy is only as good as the folks who make it up. And, you know, that's true no matter where you are. The society is only as good as its people. So if people are inclined toward crime, you know, we have to address the roots of it, what's going on, why. And the church should always be very sensitive to those kinds of questions, particularly because it deals with people's souls, right? Not just legislation. The church insists upon the need for humane attitude toward all suspects, persons under investigation, and those caught in criminal intent. The crude and improper treatment of people can either fortify them on the wrong track or push them onto it. For this reason, those awaiting a verdict should not be disenfranchised, even in custody. They should be guaranteed advocacy and impartial justice. The church condemns torture and indignities. This is important. You know, we're not for waterboarding, guys. You know, seriously, there are a lot of people that would say it's fine. But the Christians should adamantly say, no, torture is outside the pale of what we can do in terms of investigation and stopping any kind of criminal enterprise. So the church would condemn that, period. And the priest, even with a view to assist the police, cannot violate the secrecy of confession and other pastoral safeguards. So if you come to me, Ryan, and tell me, even though you're not Orthodox, if you come to me and tell me, and as a pastoral conversation, not just to run your mouth, but Father Justin and I had to talk about something, I killed somebody. I cannot go to the police, even though it's not confession even. I can't go to the police and tell them what happened. And I certainly can if it's confession. I'd be defrocked if I revealed something that was said in confession. So there are things a priest... Generally speaking, if there's a danger to people's lives, and it said, I'm summing up some of the text here, but if there's a danger to people's lives, a priest can take action to protect the person who might be harmed. But I can't, I'm trying to think of, well, one example would be child abuse. If I know that someone in the parish, someone confessed child abuse, whatever kind, if I know it's happening, But I should tell him as a condition of his absolution, you must now go to the police. I'll go with you. I'll stand with you. I'll be there with you. You know, if he refuses, though, I can't give him absolution, because the condition for repenting of a crime is turning yourself in. I mean, that's the penance, right? You have to bear the consequence of your deed, generally speaking. So in the case of someone who had abused a kid, I'd have to go with him. If he wouldn't go, I can't give him absolution, but I can't reveal it either. But I can go to parents and the parents, you need to watch your kid, keep your kids safe. Or if I know someone's being victimized, I can go and stop it, you know, and restrict, you know, without revealing exactly who the perpetrator is. So it's a very kind of sticky situation. I've not dealt with that particular issue as a pastor, thank God. Thank God. So I know priests who have, though, and it's not pleasant. It's awful. So, yeah, if the penitent is not willing to make an authentic repentance and bear the consequences, then the pastor, though he must keep it secret, cannot integrate him back into the community of the communing faithful.
Has the diocese or the OCA changed and increased what you're supposed to do in the last few years with it? Because, you know,
absolutely.
Now you have to sign even to be around kids in church and all that.
Absolutely, no. The bishop blessed, we have very strict guidelines in the national office about child safety. We have our own policy that actually got out before the OCA put theirs. Ours meets the criteria of what the OCA does, but we started ours even before the OCA made us have a very strict policy. We always had a two adult rule, two adults in a room with kids, always. That was from the time I got here that was implemented. But now we have a whole child safety manual, and it's about 4 pages long, and it has anyone who's a teacher or a chaperone has to fill it out and get a background check. And frankly, background checks don't really catch much, but it's a speed bump to someone just coming in the church and saying, oh, I mean, like, you know, you're new to the church, Ryan. Imagine if you're a predator, you could easily come in not knowing anybody and just become the youth director real fast. Well, our policies don't allow that. So someone can't just come in and assert himself and you know, and have access to our children. So you have to be a member for a year, I think. For a whole year. You have to pass the background check. You have to be interviewed by a group of three people who are on the committee for child safety. And you have to have the priest's blessing. If any of those things don't happen, you don't get to serve. And, you know, if I suspect someone has an issue, it gives me a veto, you know, pastorally. I don't have to give a reason. I just say you can't serve, you know. So that's how that works. Anyway, good question. We're really strict. Yeah. And I think it's a pretty good system, actually. Punishment. Let's talk about punishment for a second. Any crime committed and condemned by law presupposes a fair punishment, right? The meaning in Christian ideology of punishment is always reformation, right? It isn't just punishment to sort of get a penalty paid. For us, it must be ultimately about reforming. Of course, in law, there are two principles. There is always a sense that if someone does wrong, there should be something that he pays. But ultimately, for us, the more important piece of that is going to be reformation of the character. And so the church, without taking upon herself the being judge, is called to take care of the soul of every prisoner. And that is why we would see the time of imprisonment as hopefully a time of purification and renewal. So confinement, banishment, exile, labor, fines, all these things can be considered punishments, penalties that could help reform somebody rather than just, you know, beat them over the head. So, but this is why we're concerned. Our church is concerned with things like, you know, our sentences reflecting or not reflecting the crime that was committed. You know, some of these drug sentences. A lot of Christians, I know Catholics and Episcopalians and Orthodox, who are active in saying that's not just, you know, to have a couple ounces of marijuana and be in jail for 5 years. It's crazy, you know, things like that. And so, in fact, right now across the country, partly through the influence, I think, of nonprofit organizations not just our church, of course, but many churches, the prison population is dropping as we reassess all these kind of crazy narcotics laws, which are frankly particularly harsh on like the African American community. So these are things the church should care about, though, honestly. Remember the words of Jesus, "I was in prison and you came to me." This is the idea that has to animate what we do. The death penalty is another topic. As a special punishment, it was recognized in the Old Testament. There's no indication in the New Testament that we have to abolish it. However, whenever the church has gotten established someplace, one of the things that tends to happen is there's this impulse to ban or limit the death penalty. This happened under Constantine. Actually went through a phase where he tried to abolish it. Interestingly enough, he abolished the gladiator games and he abolished abortion and infanticide. He did a bunch of good things. But Prince Vladimir also, when he became Christian, abolished the death penalty in Russia. It didn't last. But the point is, there's a really good impulse in Christianity to say, is this necessary or not? I remember I had a Catholic morality class in school. I went to Catholic school. And the deacon shared, he said, he gave the Roman view, and I think this is the Orthodox view as well. He said, you know, if you have an island of people, 50 souls, and they're trying to eke out a living, and someone is a serial rapist, you have to do something with him. And you can't really lock him. You only have 50 people. You can't have someone guard him all. You're barely surviving. You've got to do something to safeguard your people, and so you execute him. You know, that's kind of... But nowadays, it's actually more costly to execute somebody than it is to put them away into a prison. You know, so his point was, we shouldn't be absolutist about these things. Like, obviously, taking a life is bad, but there's not a prohibition against it necessarily in our faith. But there's this intuition in Orthodoxy that if we can avoid it, we'd like to avoid it. And I think that's a pretty obvious position, I hope. But we're pro-life. You know, we care about life from the beginning to the end. And that's going to be a theme we come back to as we go through this stuff tonight and tomorrow and next week as well. So, okay. I think that's... Any questions about crime, punishment, reformation?
I had a question, like, going back to... Because I'm never was clear on this, especially in today's climate.
Yeah.
But if someone comes to the priest and confesses something major, like murder or child abuse, and then down the road, eventually, they make it to the court of law, and it makes it there, makes it to trial and everything, what protections does the priest have?
I think, strictly speaking, according to law, he doesn't have it. Strictly speaking, in some states, I could be forced to testify. But I wouldn't testify. And I think most prosecutors and most lawyers understand that. And they kind of have this respect for it. So I'm not aware of any prosecutions done in the last 50 years okay. with this as an issue.
Okay.
The one loophole would be in cases of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That would be the one place where...
And that was the main thing that was...
Because they're a victim, my wife knows the legal language. There's a certain category of victim, and the law goes overboard into overdrive to get justice for them.
Mm-hmm.
So certain rules are broken, including perhaps the one toward the priest. But again, this is where my role is to make my job is to make the kids safe if I know what's happened. My job is not to spill the beans on this man's confession. So I would parse that with my bishop. I'd probably call my bishop up and say, "Vladika, here's what happened." Because I can tell my bishop anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's my lifeline.
Right.
I can call him up and say, "Hey, here's what's happened. This is confidential. What do I do?" And he'd tell him what to do. That's why you have a bishop.
I just didn't know how much of an issue that's become, if it has been an issue.
Not really. And I think priests are very sensitive to this issue anyway. And, you know, usually, frankly, usually either someone will come and bring this to the priest knowing he wants to change, or it will be something where he's caught and hasn't ever confessed it before. Mm-hmm. I think those would be the two scenarios most likely, right? You're not probably going to have someone who's regularly abusing kids.
Who's also regularly going to confession.
Right. Exactly. If he's doing it, he's going to hide it, I think. Right. So.
I was more on the court side. I don't know if there was any sense of, especially since you said technically you don't really have the protection of the courts.
I don't think so.
If there's any situations where they were pressured so much to give some type of...
Again, maybe there was some pressure, but I'm not aware of any case where it was a big deal where I heard about it. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of a case one way or the other, mm-hmm. where he refused or where the state made him and he gave in. But I think I would have heard about it, though, because that's an issue that the clergy would be really concerned about. Mm-hmm. And not just our clergy, but the Catholic clergy, mm-hmm. too, because they have the same, they're even maybe perhaps even sort of stricter about it, right. in a certain sense. They actually have a canonical, for us, it's considered wrong. For them, there's all these rules about it. That's why I say they might be stricter. In fact, they're not stricter. It's just they have all this structure in Rome. We're disorganized.
Welcome to Orthodoxy.
Welcome to Orthodoxy. So personal, family, and public morality. This is a really interesting section here. We're going to talk about women.
Oh, good.
Yes.
I'm sure I won't have anything to say
about that. I'm going to read and let us reflect on some of it. Paragraph 1. The difference between the sexes is a special gift of the Creator to human beings. So God created man in his image, it says, and in the image of God created he man, male and female created he them. Genesis 1. As equal bearers of the divine image and human dignity, man and woman are created to be completely united in love. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Genesis 2. So far so good?
So far so good.
Okay. Fulfilling the Lord's original will for the creation, the marital union becomes a means of continuing and multiplying the human race. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subdue it. Genesis 1. The sexual distinctions are not limited to the difference in constitution. Man and woman are two different modes of existence in one humanity. They need communication and complementation. However, in the fallen world, relationships between the sexes can be perverted, ceasing to be an expression of God-given love, and falling into sinful passion of the fallen man for his own ego. So there's this complementarity vision here, for sure. While appreciating deeply the feat of voluntary virginal celibacy assumed for the sake of Christ and the gospel, and recognizing the special role of monasticism in the past and in the present, the Church has never, ever disparaged marriage, but denounces those who abase matrimonial relations out of wrongly understood purity. So this document was written in 2000. In the time after communism's fall, 1991, there was a whole rash of revivalism in Russia. The Church just surged back into influence, and people were getting baptized left and right. It was really a great, exciting... I was there. It was an exciting time in the Church. It still is exciting, but it was really exciting then. But you had all these guys being ordained who had no clue. And they were going to be holy elders, these young guys who didn't go to seminary, who had been Orthodox a year or two, and they become priests, and they tell people, and they have this monastic vision, think like hardcore Rokor, everyone should be abstaining from sex, and this kind of stuff is a very common feature with newbie Orthodoxy, kind of hardcore, max, to everything really extreme. So this document really reflects a pushback against a lot of those extreme kind of positions that are not really Christian. Though, in eras of rigorism, these positions were popular. Have you heard of the Encratites? They were a second century Christian sect. They were condemned as heretics in the second century. I think Irenaeus condemns them. But they were basically Orthodox, except they preached the flesh was bad. And so Christians should abstain from all sexual expressions. They were Orthodox other than that. But they insisted upon this and mandated this. And the bishops had to excommunicate them. So anyway, but this tendency pops up here and there. So, Apostolic Canon 51, which is part of our canon law, reads this: if anyone abstains from marriage, not by way of religious restraint, but is abhorrent, forgetting that God made all things good, and that he made the male and female, and blaspheming the work of creation, let him be corrected, or else, if a clergyman, let him be deposed, that is, defrocked, and cast out of the ministry. So these are very strong words about how we deal with people that would teach this. And there's a bunch of other canons here. I'm not going to read them all. According to the Roman law, which was the basis for the civil codes in most of modern European states, marriage is a contract between two parties free in their choice. The church has basically accepted this definition and now interprets on the basis of the Holy Scriptures. So we accept this: two people coming together, you know, to live together, and they agree to do it voluntarily, and that's the sort of legal foundation of marriage. The Roman jurist Modestinus gave this definition for marriage: marriage is the union of man and woman, communion of life, participation together in the divine human law. Almost unchanged, this definition was brought into the canonical books of our church, such as the Nomo Canon by Patriarch Photius and many others. So the early church had no problem leaning on the Roman idea of marriage, except they added to it this idea that Christ is the fulfillment of that. Remember Romans, Ephesians 5, the epistle we read, and the one you love so much, the one in the marriage service, it begins with wives meet with your husband, but then it continues: the husband's the head of the house. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it. So, and then of course, but what's going on there for the Orthodox is that is Christ in his church becomes, the man and wife becomes the image of Christ in the church, and vice versa. The two reflect each other. Christ in the church, man and wife. And so there's this sort of synchronicity going on there that we really, really like, that St. Paul brings out. And so for us, we take the civil understanding of Roman marriage and we then baptize it with this vision of St. Paul. And it makes it something much broader and more sacramental. So for Christians, then marriage is not just a marriage contract, a means of reproduction or satisfying our temporal sexual needs, but according to Chrysostom, it's a mystery of love, an eternal union of spouses in Christ. From the beginning, Christians sealed their marriage with the church's blessing in the sharing of the Eucharist. And that was how the early church celebrated marriage. Nowhere do you find Christians saying, don't get civilly married. We got civilly married according to the customs of Rome, or wherever we were. Well, if you're in Africa, if you're in Egypt, you did what they did. And then you would go to the church and be blessed with the chalice and take communion together. And maybe there'd be a prayer that would be said over you by the bishop, and you're married. It's that simple. It's only in the 9th century where you find an actual wedding service that becomes universal pretty much in Christianity, well, at least Eastern Christianity. The West is a little bit earlier, I think, than that, but not much. But this is a relatively late thing. 9th century, you have the full wedding rite as we know it now developing, and then the church, if you're Christian, the church takes over certifying your marriage, making it all legitimate in the eyes of the state. But before that, you simply got married with the state, did your family marriage customs, and then you went to the bishop and he blessed it, and you had communion together, and you're married. So, but the point is, to today, you still get a blessing. You still get a blessing from the church. And secondly, we still value the secular stamp. I think that's why it was so hard for many. I rather like the history of our church being connected to I don't mean a state church, but I like the fact that our church can partner with the state and say, we're doing a wedding and the priest is partnering with the state to preside. And I have the authority by the church and by the state to pronounce you man and wife. That's a very ancient tradition given to the church by Constantine. It goes back that far. And so I think a lot of Orthodox have a hard time with the idea that we might be coming to a time where marriage civilly and marriage in the church are totally separated because of the whole same-sex marriage issue. It's probably going to happen. But I hate to see that happen because this is a great privilege that we've always had to marry people in the church since the 4th century. So, anyway. So the church has always acknowledged the civil part of it. And even when a couple isn't blessed in the church, we see their marriage as being an authentic marriage. You know, so if you were to run off tomorrow and marry someone, Sarah, you couldn't take communion. But if you contracted the marriage lawfully and you were married, you'd be married. You wouldn't be falsely married. You'd just be married outside the church. Do you see what I'm saying?
So because it's outside of the church, I couldn't take communion.
That's right. Strictly speaking. Yeah, so if you have an Orthodox guy or if you're Orthodox and you get married outside the church, technically that would bar you from the Eucharist.
It's like divorce with Catholics.
However, the way you remedy that is you get married in the church. Or if it's been a long time and the pastor knows that it was a mistake, like if you did it now, you'd know better. Mm-hmm. But let's say your mom was Orthodox and baptized you and you didn't know much. And you were just baptized Orthodox and you got married to some guy. And now you're really serious about the faith and he's Jewish. Well, according to canon law, you can't marry an Orthodox Christian and a Jewish person. They have to have the same faith. So what do? You've been married to this guy for 20 years. You've got kids with him. Do I tell you to leave your husband? No. No. So there's always you have to have a pastoral sense about these things. And this document actually says that, gives that very example. You know, pastors have to discern carefully. Was it in rebellion that they got married outside? Was it ignorance? Was it just youthful whatever? That all matters.
We've got several in the church.
We do.
That are.
We do, and strictly speaking, according to canon law, they shouldn't go to communion. However, by the grace of God and economia, they do. But they've all gone to confession. They've all dealt with it, and thank God for that. So, and that's where we differ. The Catholics, you know, they don't have a mechanism for that. I don't think you have to. You know, am I right about that, David?
I think so.
Yeah. In Orthodoxy, if it's been a while, long enough, you just sort of like, well, Lord have mercy, you cross yourself, and you give it to confession. So strictly, I'm departing from my notes now, but that's okay. So mixed marriages. Mixed marriages in Orthodoxy, depends on what you mean by them. Can we do them? Well, if you're marrying a Muslim, no. I cannot bless a marriage between a Muslim and a Christian. We can bless, however, a marriage between a Catholic and Orthodox, as evidenced over there. The two of them got married in the Orthodox Church. David's Catholic and Olga's Orthodox. And they involve both clergy, is that right? You talk to your priest, and she talked to her priest. And
they have to talk to the bishop.
And they had to talk to the bishop, and it's kind of a pain for everybody. And there's the question of how you raise your kids, which is you know, technically, the Orthodox would ask you to affirm you're going to raise them Orthodox, and your priest would ask you to raise them Catholic, you know? And so that's a challenge. So I found that with, like, certain Protestants, it might not be a problem if they're friendly to the church. But generally, I think I've only married people of different faiths who are a little older, and usually post having children, and we have some people in our parish like that, and I don't think it's a problem really, if they're older and not going to have kids. So there are many Orthodox saints actually who were women, particularly who were married to like non-Orthodox men, even some cases Muslim men, because they were part of dynastic things going on. So you know, there's the rules, and we break the rules all the time, even in Orthodoxy. So, you've heard of Grand Duchess Elizabeth, right? You know, when she married the Grand Prince of Russia, she was a Lutheran, and she didn't have to convert. She chose to convert 10 years later, you know. So, you know.
So if an Orthodox person marries a Muslim, they can't receive communion, so that rule would apply to them.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, if an Orthodox were to marry a Muslim, that would be an impediment to taking communion. Because we couldn't marry them in the church, you know. But, you know, if it was something, it depends. You know, if Sarah goes off and marries a Muslim, you know what you're doing. You're just marrying a Muslim guy. But, you know, if one of our kids, you know, if some kid grows up outside the church, I mean, he's Orthodox, baptized, but hasn't practiced his entire life, and then comes back to the faith, and he's married a Muslim girl, I'd talk to the bishop about it. You know, Vladika, what can we do? You know, this kid was ignorant. He didn't know.
I mean, what if the priest says it's okay for the marriage to proceed?
The bishop would depose him, I think. Again, I know of exceptions in history. There were cases of Orthodox women who were married to Muslim caliphs, you know, forcibly. But, you know, we'll talk about this afterwards. I've never heard that before. I've never heard of a Muslim and Orthodox marrying.
I have a friend who's marrying a Muslim.
Has she talked to the priest?
Yeah, he said it's okay. But the Muslim is not practicing.
He's not practicing Muslim.
Wow.
I'm interested in knowing more about that. I won't say more on the recording now. Okay. All right. So, the church insists that spouses remain faithful for life, that Orthodox marriage is indissoluble on the base of the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, what God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, shall marry another, committeth adultery. So divorce is a sin, right? We definitely say divorce is wrong, but it's very complicated now. The Lord pointed to adultery as the one possible ground for divorce. It defiles the sanctity of marriage and breaks the bond of faithfulness. In cases where spouses suffer from all kinds of conflict, the church sees it as her pastoral task to use all means appropriate, such as prayer, exhortation, sacramental life, referring to counseling, to safeguard the integrity of the marriage and to prevent a divorce. The clergy are also called to talk to the couple before they get married, to work with them. You know, I know the Catholics now have a very elaborate program before marriage. You guys, at my recommendation, did premarital counseling together. We did a couple sessions together, not tons, but we had conversations, though, about what was going on. And, you know, before you signed on the dotted line. Unfortunately, though, sometimes spouses are unable to preserve the gift of grace they received in the sacrament and to keep, you know, their family together because of their sinful imperfection. In desire to save sinners, the church gives them an opportunity to reform and is ready to readmit them to the sacraments after they make repentance. So, there are some cases when the church might allow a divorced couple who divorce to remarry. Some of those, especially if it's one spouse is really pushing for the divorce, here are some of the issues that might come into play. If someone falls away from the Orthodox or Christian faith, some kind of perversion, an impotence which was hidden before the marriage, so like an inability to consummate the marriage, contraction of leprosy or syphilis, like a venereal disease, prolonged disappearance, like he's lost, conviction in like exile, right, like in like a long-term life sentence or something, the encroachment on the life or health of the spouse, like abuse or something. A love affair with the daughter-in-law. Prostitution. Profiting by the spouse's indecency. Prostitution. Incurable mental disease. Malevolent abandonment of the spouse. Alcoholism, drug addiction, or abortion without the husband's consent. These would all be things that would be immediate kind of red flags. We would really, really, really discourage a no-fault divorce. Like, oh, I just don't like him anymore. Or she's just a pain in the butt. Like, we can't bless that or encourage that in any way. For the spiritual education of those contracting marriage, the clergy are urged before selling the marriage to give a detailed explanation of what will be entailed. The general says the divorce is the last resort and can be sought only if spouses committed actions defined by the church, like the ones I just read, as cause for divorce. Consent for the dissolution of marriage cannot be given to satisfy a whim or to confirm a common law divorce. However, if a divorce is an accomplished fact, when spouses are living separately. The restoration of family is considered impossible. Then the church can recognize a divorce has taken place. If things have clearly moved on, they're not together, it's a fiction now. The marriage is dead. The church does not approve of a second marriage. However, a second marriage might be allowed, particularly to the innocent spouse, in what's happened. Those whose marriage was dissolved to their own fault might be allowed to remarry only after an extended penance in accordance with the Holy Canons, which could be a long time without the sacrament. So, anyway, there's some rules about third marriage, but it's very, very rare in Orthodoxy to have third marriage. So, there was actually a whole, War of the Roses about the third marriage at one point. Someone tried to do a fourth marriage, and the patriarch excommunicated the emperor. So, anyway. So we would discourage divorce, absolutely. In the Russian church, they actually have a church divorce court. The Greeks have this as well. The OCA has nothing like this. I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Father George, my friend over the Greek church, he was here for many years. He had to go up to Detroit once every month. He'd hear divorce cases for the diocese. It's like the annulment process for the Catholics, which I don't like. But I'm really glad. In the ancient church, there was no such court. It simply was a matter of if the marriage broke down and dissolved at some point after penance, perhaps you could contract a second marriage with the blessing of the bishop. So, and we follow that practice here. If someone wants to contract a second marriage, I have to call the bishop or write the bishop, explain the situation, tell him, kind of affirm, I think this marriage could work. They've worked through their issues, whatever killed the first marriage they're aware of, so we're not playing with fire here. So we take that really, really seriously, recognizing that, of course, Jesus says you shouldn't get married again, but he also says better to marry than to burn. And so we'd have that kind of, we definitely would say a second marriage isn't great. It just is sometimes.
So are you saying typically, is the bishop aware of all weddings that all the priests are doing in the canon?
I think,
because I can tell you for a fact that in my old church, Orthodox, two friends got divorced. They'd been married 16, 18 years.
Yeah.
And in our same church, a year or two later, priests married one of them that got divorced to somebody else.
Well, then that can happen, but it's not ideal. But, the bishop might have blessed it. I don't know. Maybe. I'm not saying it's impossible. It just, we should be very careful about it, I think. And,
What if a non-believer who is divorced enters the church?
Right.
What about marriage to someone?
Typically, the church has been much more gracious in that regard. If someone enters the church having been married in the past, and there's someone who's not been married before, typically it's like a first wedding. And pastorally, that makes sense, I think. I think if you have kids involved, it's a little complicated. But as a pastor, I would still not want it to be a dark, dreary affair. I'd tell them, rejoice, be glad. God's being merciful to you. That's a good thing. So, I don't want to be too dark about this. I think it's just part of the reality of human nature in a broken world. And so we have second marriages. And that's not ideal, but it is. So, but all this stuff is what is. This is not ideal. This is how do we translate the gospel into the nuts and bolts of a really messed up life. Right? So, the idea of death itself is wrong. So, 2 points here. Marriage for us has two main principles: to be procreative and to be unitive. The two of those things are very important for us. There's a whole page on this. I'm not going to read it to you, but think about that. That's the twofold purpose: procreative and unitive. And if one of them doesn't happen, if you can't procreate, at least you have the unitive thing going on. And that's really, really important. Chrysostom said in the 4th century, he said, you know, we're supposed to reproduce, it's really good, but, you know, we've already filled the earth up with people already. He said that in the 4th century. So, you know, we want to be mindful to have children, and we'll talk here probably next week about birth control questions and stuff like that, which might be interesting to you. Okay, let's jump over here to personal and national health. Any questions? So personal and national health. At all times, the church has been concerned with human health, both spiritual and physical. From the Orthodox perspective, however, the physical health divorced from the spiritual is not an absolute value. So we want to hold the physical and the spiritual together. That's our task in everything. The biblical attitude to medicine is expressed most fully in the book of Sirach. So I'm going to read a little passage here. It's really cool. Honor a doctor with the honor due to him for the uses which you may have of him. For the Lord hath created him, that is the doctor. For the Most High cometh healing. The Lord hath created medicines out of the earth, and he that is wise will not abhor the medicines. He that hath given men skill that he might be honored in his marvelous work. With such doth he heal men and take away their pains. Of such doth the apothecary make a confection, and of his works there is no end. From him is peace over the whole earth. My son, in thy sickness, be not negligent, but pray to the Lord, he will make thee whole. Leave off from sin, order thy hands aright, cleanse thy heart, and then give place to the physician, for the Lord hath made him. Let him not go from thee, for thou hast need of him. There is a time when in their hands there is good success. For they also shall pray to the Lord that he would prosper them, and he would give them remedy to prolong their life. So there's this beautiful weaving together of the spiritual and the physician, right? And that would be our vision as well. We would want to have a holistic view that God is at work through the hands of the doctors. And we have this tradition in Orthodoxy, these wonderful unmercenary healing saints. You've heard of them before? St. Panteleimon, St. Cosmas and Damian, St. Hermolaus. There are a number of other ones too, but these are saints who are doctors who would go around healing people, and they would mingle their preaching with their healing work, and the two would just go hand in glove perfectly. So the Orthodox Church has always treated the medical work with high respect, as it is based on the service of love to others and aims to prevent and relieve the suffering of mankind. So this is a very good vision. Many illnesses are still incurable and cause suffering and death. In the face of these illnesses, the church is called to rely upon the goodwill of God. The Christians should rely upon the goodwill of God, remembering that the meaning of life is not limited to earthly life. Suffering is a consequence not only of our personal sins, but even more of the general distortion and limitation of the human nature as a whole. And as such, we can endure it with patience and hope. And he goes on to say, because the Lord takes on that suffering himself. We can endure it because the Lord does. And so while we want to relieve our suffering and we should go to doctors at some point, we're all going to reach a point where we can't continue. And so we want to turn it over to God. We want to know that he's ultimately healing our souls. And that is paramount in a sense. When human resources are exhausted, the Christian should remember that God's strength is made perfect in weakness. And that in the depths of suffering, he can meet Christ, who took upon himself all our afflictions. So, and that's why we're really okay with things like do not resuscitate. You know, because at the end of the day, we want to be natural in a sense, and our hope. There's a real problem with some doctors. They want to drag it out because there's this. The only hope is this life, and for us, our hope is in God. So we have no problem saying enough. You know, we're done. It's okay. A believing medical worker should understand that a person who needs his help expects from him not only appropriate treatment, but also spiritual support. The duty of every Orthodox medical worker is to be for the patient the merciful Samaritan that's in the gospel. So this is a very high calling, to be a doctor, a nurse, to care for the sick. The church gives her blessing for Orthodox brothers and sisters to work in clinics and other healthcare institutions. to help found hospital churches, as well as monastery hospitals, to give medical aid in all stages of treatment, combined with pastoral care. Of course, this is hard in America. We don't have the resources necessarily. But in Russia, there are hospitals now all over the country where you have monasteries. St. Elizabeth I mentioned her already, St. Elizabeth, the new martyr, had a series of hospitals built throughout Russia to heal people, and now those are being restored. And so today in Moscow and Minsk and other places, there are these really wonderful hospitals staffed by nuns, which is kind of neat. So the church finally is called to participate in collaboration with state structures and concerned public circles in the development of such conception of national health care, whereby every person could exercise his right to spiritual, physical, mental health, and social welfare under maximum life expectancy. That sounds pretty socialist, doesn't it? He goes on to say that the church doesn't give any preference to any one model over another, but it's pretty clear in the Russian document that the church has an interest in encouraging the state to be active and be a positive agent in taking care of people. You know, there's nothing unorthodox or unchristian at all about caring about the poor and extending them health care. This is a very good thing from a Christian perspective. And we should really be thought, you know, we should really be impacted by our faith as regards things like, you know, Social Security and the poor, the old, who have no recourse. It was really terrible before the 60s. You know, there was no, if you were old, you had no health care. And people, you just die. There's nothing. Anyway, there's a whole paragraph or two here that's very typical of the Russian church. They warn against the occult and medical practices, alternative medicines being a little sketchy. There's also a two paragraphs on the demographic crisis Russia faces, which is really acute. It mentions all the wars, the revolutions, abortion. Abortion's huge. The number one, there was a period of time, I think, when in Soviet history where more babies were aborted than were born. And it's still very high in Russia right now, the abortion rate. So, and the church, of course, opposes that. But, you know, it has impacted the law, but not as much as you would hope. So, the church regards mental diseases as manifestations of the general sinful distortion of mankind. Singling out the spiritual, mental, and bodily levels of the structure of personality, the fathers drew a distinction between diseases which develop from nature and the infirmities caused by demonic powers. So we want to be clear with, in talking about mental illness, that there's a distinction between mental illness, like a physiological thing, and then sort of like a spiritual thing. And oftentimes it's been my experience and the church's experience that there's the two work together. Sometimes there's like some real illness going on and then the devil takes advantage of it. And a lot of times treating the medical aspect can be helped significantly by someone going to confession and trying to live a very mindful life in Christ. The two can be very, very helpful. You know, I see the fruits of it in a lot of people's lives. Glory to God. We don't despise medicine, you know, for people who are having mental struggles necessarily. In my experience, probably about 2/3 of the things that would be, you might label afflictions, are really helped by some medication. You know, I've seen people be over-medicated too. So, you know, I've seen a lot of different results, but we don't view that as a failure or a sign of spiritual slackness necessarily. You know, it just, if you're sick, you take it, you know, if you're sick, you go to the doctor. And if you have cancer, you get chemotherapy, you know. It's not pleasant. It's not something you're really happy about. But sometimes you need to do it for the sake of your whole life.
I've been told that if your demons, quote unquote, your issues, your struggles are down in a dark cave, it's much easier to fight them if you choose to go into the cave than if you're dragged into the cave and kicking and screaming, yeah, whatever. And that's, you know, that's what med medication helps with. It helps you get out of the cave so you can choose to go down in.
Right, exactly.
As opposed
that's a good example.
Dragged right
in. Absolutely. So, and ideally, the priest and the psychological advisor or the psychotherapist would be talking to each other. That hasn't always worked well, just speaking honestly. Sometimes it's worked okay, other times it hasn't. Part of it's just perspective, too. So if someone is struggling with something they would say that they as an Orthodox Christian believe is wrong, and the therapist says, well, that's fine. And the priest is like, no, that's really wrong. And we have a fundamental different worldview kind of thing. That's a problem. And a lot of therapists will just sort of repeat back what you tell them. So it's called active listening. So how do you feel? Oh, I feel fine. Right? I did this, and how do you feel about that? Or you did this, and there's all this sort of dialogue, and it can get a little weird. And it's not always good, it's not always bad, but I think it takes a really skilled practitioner to be a good therapist. Not anyone can be a therapist, and a lot of people that aren't very good at it are doing it. So, anyway, couple more thoughts here to wrap this up. Alcohol. There's a whole couple of paragraphs here. It's Russia, right? Vodka. It's a huge problem sociologically. In our church tradition, alcohol is good. It's good to have alcohol. Wine to gladden the heart of man. It is good, the sage says, if drunk moderately. Of course, the question is, well, what happens when you don't drink moderately? Well, you get alcoholism. And if that happens, you have to act boldly and swiftly to cut it out because it's considered a root of many other vices and sins. So this is not in here, but it should be. The most effective programs that I've seen ever with alcoholism are like the AA 12-step programs by far. There's nothing that compares to them. I've known so many people in my life who were alcoholics who've been really transformed by those programs. Other addictions aren't quite as effective. Maybe the narcotics might come close, but there's other addictive 12-step programs like Overeater Anonymous. That's not so bad. Sexaholic Anonymous is very sketchy. I'm not sure I would endorse that, actually. So there are different, there are different kind of addictions and different support groups for them, but the most effective of them all is AA. And maybe second would be the Alcoholics Al-Anon, which is for the spouses and the family, kids and stuff. That's really effective too. Because you're processing what alcoholism was like for you as a victim of it, so to speak. So, the principal reason for the desire of many of our people to escape into a realm of alcoholic or narcotic illusion is spiritual emptiness, loss of meaning in life, blurred moral guiding lines. Drug addiction and alcoholism point to the spiritual disease that has affected not only the individual, but our society. This is a retribution for our ideology of consumerism, for the cult of material prosperity, for the lack of spirituality, and the loss of authentic ideals. In her pastoral compassion for the victims of alcoholism and drug addiction, the church offers them a spiritual support in overcoming their vice. Without denying the need of medical aid to be given at the critical stages of drug addiction, the church pays special attention to the prevention and rehabilitation, which are the most effective when those suffering are consciously in the Eucharistic and community life of our church. So we want to bring them into the church, and welcome them in as fellow sinners, but not enable them either, and have proper support for them. So one of the most beautiful things I saw when I lived in Russia was, I'll pull it out. It's called the Icon of the Inexhaustible Cup. You know this? Ne upivayam moya chasha. You know that one? This is the icon. So Christ is in the chalice, the unquenchable cup. And this is the kind of patron icon for people who are addicted to trigger drink. Mm. And they have a beautiful akathist in Russian. I have it in English too, for people who are addicted. And it's basically, O lady, fill up the thirst I have with the love of your son. Beautiful idea. But this is all over Russia. When I was there, you'd find parishes have these because alcoholism is huge. you know, for the people that were suffering with it. So, here, pass that around. And I have another section, but I think I should stop because we've been going on for about an hour. Do you have any questions for me? I'll leave the recorder on.
Does drug addiction include cigarette smoking?
That's a good question. Cigarette smoking. I think you're going to hell if you smoke cigarettes. Sorry, Jason. No, I was raised Pentecostal, and in the Pentecostal churches, if you smoked, that was a sign of real impurity. So, you know, you'd have about every couple of years, you'd have a revival come through town, and all the cigarettes would be thrown in the trash or down the toilet. And, of course, a month later, I'd be out again. Mm-hmm. But, some of the contemporary, like 19th century fathers say, like I think John of Kronstadt rails against cigarette smoking. It's like this evil, you know. But he also railed against putting sugar in your tea. I'm serious. Yeah. So you got to read some of these fathers with a grain of salt. And I don't mind this playing. I'll smoke a cigar a couple times a year. I'll smoke a pipe once or twice a year. I used to have a hookah. I'd smoke the, and I don't feel bad about that. I did that three or four times a year. I enjoyed it. I would discourage someone being addicted to it. You know, do I feel any guilt smoking that a couple? No, not at all. It's like having an ice cream, as far as I'm concerned. Is it really good for you? Probably not. But it's nice, and it's a treat, and it's something that, you know. So, like everything, if it's used very sparingly, it's probably not a big deal. But, you know, if someone's smoking a pack a day, like, for their own health, like, guys, stop. But, you know, if you wanted to make it a spiritual issue, maybe you could do that. But I wouldn't drop that on somebody, necessarily. I knew a monk. I've told this story before. A monk who smoked. He was, it was in Russia. And it was in the town of Pskov. And I forget his name. And I was in the monastery for 3 or 4 days, and I was leaving, and the abbot appointed this monk to drive me. And, you know, the monastery was very strict. And when he got in the car, the first thing he did, he lit up a cigarette. And I'm like, oh my, I was scandalized. You know, I thought monks, I was new to the church, and like, you know, monks surely would smoke. Now I know bishops would smoke, so. The monk was driving, and he could tell I was trying not to show up, but he could tell I was. So he said, I'm sorry, I'm smoking. I said, no, it's not a big deal. I said, my dad smoked, which is true. And he said, you know, I used to smoke 2 packs a day. And now the abbot lets me make a drive once a day out of the monastery. Today I'm driving you to the train station, but I get to drive out, walk or drive away, and smoke one cigarette a day. He started out, he said, I used to smoke 2 packs, and it was a pack, and then it was 5 cigarettes, and it was 3 cigarettes, and now it's 1 cigarette. And he was so proud of himself, you know. And I think that's a healthy perspective. You know, it isn't like it's an absolutely terrible thing, but if you can be free of it, go for it, you know. Because we don't want to be kicked around. I think our thought about any kind of habit is we don't want to be kicked around by it or controlled by it. Whether it's food, you know, I love food. Whether it's food or sex or it's, you know, smoking or drinking or any kind of substance, right? We don't want to be controlled by it. Money, power. So that's the rule in Orthodoxy. It's, you know, it isn't, there's nothing wrong with sex. There's nothing wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with most drugs. I mean, I'm on Sudafed, and that's basically meth, right? But if I, you know, mm-hmm. in small portions, it's not a big deal. It's just how you use it, you know. So, and I also know too, if people mature and they get older, they grow. Like things that maybe didn't bother them when they were younger bother them now, and that's good too. Let your conscience develop. I feel bad about things I didn't when I was 20. You know, I think that's probably okay. You know, I probably felt bad about things now that I don't then that I don't now. But maybe that's regression. Anyway. All right.